Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, Reuters columnist David K. Johnston will tell us how GE and the mega-rich get away with paying almost nothing in taxes. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, on the Dems, the inflated threat of the Tea Party, the decay of the USA, and the diminishing utility of race as a category of political analysis and activism. First, a few words on the U.S. economy. A phrase that's been circulating among the smarter Wall Street economists lately is stall speed. That is, economic growth has slowed to just above zero. We're not shrinking, not perfectly flat, but just barely positive. Yes, I know all the problems with economic growth, ecological destruction and maldistribution of the gains, but without a major transformation of our economic arrangements, the lack of growth presents very serious difficulties. Employment shrinks, budgets are cut, and most people find it harder than ever to pay the bills. Friday morning brought the release of the employment report for August. For only the second time in the 72-year history of the series, overall employment, as measured by the Survey of Employers, was unchanged. Zero. The previous time, by the way, was February 1945. Since this figure is almost certain to be revised next month, it's not likely to last, but zero is truly unusual. A bit of long-term perspective. Monthly employment changes are negative about a quarter of the time and positive the other three quarters. At headline zero was depressed by the strike of 46,000 workers against Verizon, which Mark Brenner of Labor Notes talked about on last week's show. Strikers are not counted as employed for the period they're off the job since they're not paid, even though those workers are actually employed. But even if you add them back to the count, a gain of under 50,000 is pretty weak. Looking under the surface, most of the major industrial sectors were little changed. Only healthcare, that perpetual standout, showed strong gains. Government shed another 17,000 workers, all because of losses at the local level. Some orthodox types like to dismiss government work as economically useless or even worse, but consider this. Local government employs more people than leisure and hospitality, almost twice as many as finance, and almost as many as professional and business services. And it pays our roads, teaches our kids, and in many cases takes care of the sick. All those basic services are under intense pressure and will continue to be unless something changes drastically. Not only was employment unchanged, the average work week fell by a tenth of an hour to its lowest level since January. And the average hourly wage also fell even before accounting for inflation. These figures come from the survey of 300,000 employers. A simultaneous survey of 60,000 households painted a somewhat brighter picture, but since it's a much smaller sample than the survey of employers, the household survey bounces around a lot from month to month. Taking a longer-term view, it's actually showing slower job growth than the so-called establishment survey. And the share of the adult population employed, though it rose a hair last month, remains stuck at the same level it was at in 1983. Before the booms of the 1980s and 90s took it to record levels in 2001. We're way below that record now. The unemployment rate was unchanged at a very high 9.1%. Nearly half a million workers had part-time work last month who wanted full-time, a hidden form of unemployment. That brought the broad unemployment rate, the so-called U6 rate, up a tenth to 16.2%. While not a record, it's not far from one, and it's also a scandal and a tragedy. While this report was not a picture of a crumbling labor market, it's not a picture of a healthy one either. The question in the coming months is whether this stall-speed economy is sustainable, or like a 747 doing just 50 miles an hour, if it's the sort of thing that precedes an unwelcome landing. Back after a musical break to talk taxes with David K. Johnston. That was some of the first movement of Robert Schumann's Fantasy for Solo Piano, performed by the great Alfred Brendel. My first guest is David K. Johnston. David is a former longtime reporter for the New York Times, who is now a columnist for Reuters. His stuff isn't too easy to find on the Reuters website itself, but you can easily track down his articles by Googling David K., that's C-A-Y, and Reuters. David K., C-A-Y, and Reuters. Johnston is a master of the tax beat. Here he is to talk about why and how corporations and the rich pay a lower tax rate than you and I do. David K. Johnston. Welcome, David. Corporate America is always whining about how heavy its tax burden is, and it gets a lot of ears in Congress, but you've been looking into GE's tax situation and found some unusual things. What'd you find?
I have. I've been looking at GE in the context of very large companies versus smaller companies. It turns out that over the last 10 years, GE's tax rate in the United States has been half its tax rate outside the United States. GE's been paying 9.4% of the profits it reports in America. Now, the tax rate's 35%, four times that high. But offshore, GE's been paying 17.9%. That's almost twice as much. And GE keeps moving more and more of its profits offshore. And Jeff Immelt, the head of GE, who is the head of President Obama's jobs creation panel, and who inherited a terrible mess left behind by Jack Welch, has been in the forefront of companies that are reducing jobs in America and moving jobs offshore. Nonetheless, since the law gives companies a lot of discretion about where they take their profits, an obvious question is, I'm sorry, why do you keep taking more and more profits in higher tax jurisdictions and less profits in the lower tax jurisdiction called the United States of America?
Before I get to answer that, why the enormous gap between the statutory rate and what GE actually pays on its domestic income?
The corporate income tax is a flat tax of 35%, but in reality, it operates just like the individual income tax. If you are making $81,000 a year as an individual and you're single and take the standard deduction, you pay the same tax rate as people who make almost $1 million a day. If you're making $100,000 to $1 million a year, that's mostly two-income professional couples, you pay a significantly higher rate than people who make more than $10 million a year. So you make $100,000 a year and you work 50 years, you'll make $5 million, and you're being taxed much more heavily by the federal government than people who will make each year twice as much as you'll earn in 50 years of work. Well, in the corporate tax, the same thing happens, Doug. There are about 6 million corporations in America, and the corporations with $500,000 of assets to $250 million, which basically means, unless it's in your neighborhood, companies you've never heard of, they pay 32% of their profits in taxes to the federal government. That's almost the 35% rate. But the 12,000 biggest companies, the ones with billions of dollars of assets, they own 80% of all the business assets in America, just 12,000 companies. Their average tax rate is only 19%. And the reason for that is that they're the ones who spend money lobbying in Washington, getting rules put together, getting favorable actions by the government, getting auditors to back off by making it clear that it'll take years and years and years to collect some sum of money, so the bosses in the IRS tell the frontline auditors who find wrongdoing, well, we just don't have the resources to pursue that. By the way, go get that poor family over there that's cheating on its earned income tax credit.
Let's linger on that point a moment. When most people get a letter from the IRS, they tremble in their shoes. Not if you're GE.
Oh, no. No big company does at all, and ordinary people shouldn't, by the way, either. This is a fiction ginned up by the anti-tax forces to make people afraid. First of all, remember that the IRS are just the tax police. They're just like the street cops in your town. They just do what they're told by Congress. And Congress has made it very clear by its funding what it wants. It has put up extra money since 1995 or 96 for the purpose of going after poor people. It has focused heavily on family-owned businesses, and it has paid virtually no attention to partnerships, where an increasing amount of business is going, surprise, surprise, and to be pro forma with the very, very biggest companies. Research by the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which gathers all sorts of raw data from the government and puts it on the web to make it understandable to mere mortals, trac.syr.edu, shows that the amount of auditing effort, the intensity of the work, has been declining for years. The amount of money they're hauling in is declining. And that's because it's the policy of the government of the United States to intensely police the tax system when it comes to the poor, when it comes to small business owners, but not when it comes to the very wealthy and big corporations.
So back to GE.
Well, General Electric says that it scrupulously complies with the law. I've written a column at my former employer raising questions about that in the country of Brazil from its own internal records, although it insists even with what the records show, repeated finding that it was engaged in invoicing schemes to reduce taxes, that it still was complying with the law. But let's accept that GE is correct about that. There are a bunch of tax credits passed during the Bush administration. Those saved GE $2.2 billion in taxes over the last 5 years. Before 5 years ago, they didn't report these credits because they weren't big enough to matter. GE undoubtedly has, in its 1,000-person tax department, found all sorts of little areas where it has created tax benefits for itself by linking up sections of the code. One of the reasons the tax code is so huge, it's not about you and me and the people listening to this show that makes the tax code so huge. It's provisions put in by companies through the congressmen they support, and those provisions often are not at all apparent to you or me. So something may be put into the law 1 year, and 3 years later something else put in, and a year after that something else put in, and then an interpretation of a regulation, and all that adds up to a loophole through which a company can push through billions of dollars without paying taxes. And you could never find that unless you have the Rosetta Stone, as the company that set it all up does.
So what about the mystery? Why is GE shifting so much of its profits to jurisdictions where it pays a higher tax rate than the U.S.? Why isn't it shelter its taxes in the United States, which is essentially a low-tax jurisdiction?
Well, significantly, Doug, Jeffrey Immelt's personal spokesman, Gary Sheffer, won't talk about that. He won't answer questions about that. The company will not make anybody available to discuss this. What we do know is that John Samuels, the chief tax lawyer at GE, has been giving speeches warning Congress about tax reform and to be very careful that a territorial tax system doesn't have unintended consequences. I think the underlying message in that is that GE shifts where places it takes profits between the U.S. and outside the U.S. depending on how it benefits GE. Now, we expect companies to be run to maximize profits, but we also expect the tax authorities to see to it that anything that affects taxes has economic substance. If you don't do that, if you don't say this transaction has to be motivated by something other than taxes, companies can just move symbols around on pieces of paper and reduce their tax burdens. And that means you and I have to pay more or get less in government services or have more of our taxes go to interest on the national debt. Well, companies that take advantage of tax-motivated transactions benefit. And the fact is, GE is so big and so complicated, I doubt the IRS has the capacity to really know what they're doing. So absent some whistleblower copying everything and sending it out, and I suspect that they're very good about compartmentalizing information, I don't think we can ever really know what they should be paying. They're paying what they want to pay, and they're paying it where they want to pay it, and they're paying it when it's most convenient for them to pay it where it works out best.
And so the IRS is staffed by people paid civil servant salaries fighting with 1,000-person tax departments of very, very well-compensated elite lawyers and accountants, right?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, by the way, you and I as taxpayers finance the training for the lawyers who then go to work for these big companies. Smart, young people who want to go into tax, which is requires a very high degree of intellectual capacity and clear-headed thinking, go to work for the IRS, and the ones who get identified as being smart and who play ball suddenly find themselves working at the big accounting firms, the big law firms, and the big corporations, working against the interests of you and me and every other taxpayer after having been trained on how it works on the inside at the taxpayer expense. Wonderful system!
And I assume you focused on GE because they're very prominent and very good at what they do, but I also imagine quite typical of large corporations, right?
Well, I think GE is a particularly important example because it has been so focused on reducing taxes because of its closeness to the administration and because of its tremendous importance. I mean, depending on what year it is, it's the first, second, or third biggest company in America by stock market value. I mean, why would I go waste my time writing about Harry's Metal Bending Company in Youngstown, Ohio? Let's deal with the important things first. And GE has, by its actions, chosen to be a poster boy to be looked at on tax issues.
A while back, I saw a graphic on the web of what Google does. I mean, it moves a lot of its profits through Ireland and the Netherlands Antilles, and it was really just moving money and symbols around all over the place. Is GE doing that sort of thing? And how many companies do that? Is it everyone? All the big guys doing that?
Doug, everybody who's multinational does this. You take advantage of the laws in Singapore or Hong Kong or Bermuda or the Netherlands or the Caribbean island companies to put expenses in the U.S. or other high-tax jurisdictions and take your profits in low-tax jurisdictions. And it turns out, because of these business credits and other things going on, that GE is taking profits here in the U.S. Now, GE did have, for 1 year, losses. But when you look at the 10 years of GE, the trend is very clear. Falling tax rate against its profits and more of its profits going offshore where the tax rate is steady to rising.
I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who, among other things, is a columnist for Reuters. There's a big controversy now because a lot of multinationals have a lot of retained earnings, hundreds of billions of dollars stashed abroad, and they're trying to get some kind of tax holiday to repatriate the funds. So tell us about that.
Well, Doug, this is a case where we actually have history as to what will happen. The proposed 2011 American Jobs Creation Act, I think that's the precise title of it, is patterned after the 2004 American Jobs Creation Act. And back then, Senator Ensign of Nevada, who of course has since resigned in disgrace after paying people off to shut up about his peccadilloes, or his family paid them off, he said if you pass this law, it'll create 660,000 jobs because American companies will bring home roughly $90 billion of untaxed profits offshore. American law gives companies a dollar-for-dollar credit for taxes paid. So if you pay a dollar tax to the Germans, you reduce your American taxes by a dollar. If you're the Saudis, you're smart about this, you say, you know what, we're not going to raise the price of oil, we're going to raise the tax on oil. And then when you pay us, instead of getting a 35-cent deduction for the oil you buy from us, you get a $1 deduction for the tax that you pay us, because Saudi Arabia is basically, like several other countries, a family business. Well, they brought back $90 billion. The biggest portion of it in 2004 went to Pfizer, $37 billion. Saved them $11 billion in taxes, because instead of paying 35%, they paid 5.25%. And how many jobs did they create? Well, almost on the very day the money came back, Pfizer started firing people. And so far, they've fired more than 40,000 people. I think it should be called the 2004 American Jobs Destruction Act. What did they use the money for? Well, they used it to buy back Pfizer stock. Why would they do that? Well, Pfizer stock wasn't rising in value. If it doesn't rise in value, the executives can't make money on their stock options. Unfortunately, for Pfizer, its stock price has continued to fall despite the beneficence of the American taxpayer in trying to help the executives prop up the stock price artificially, and those executives were not worth anything. Their options weren't worth anything because the stock price kept falling. If we do this again, some of the money will be used by some companies to hire, but I think that we can expect the same pattern. Unless the law is carefully crafted, and it's not now, the money will be used to buy back stock, to pay out dividends. It will not be used to create jobs, and it will encourage companies to do more and more taking profits offshore where the money will grow untaxed until they decide to bring it home and they get a law passed that says, hey, we'll give you an 85% reduction in your tax rate. Bring the money home.
Now, switching to the personal realm, during the, I was going to say recent, but perpetual budget melodrama, it's clear that increasing taxes on rich folks has absolutely been ruled out, and there are several arguments for this. One is that raising taxes on rich people will hurt job creation. Another is that they're already severely burdened, and another is that there's not that much money there anyway, so why bother? What do you say to those arguments?
You know, when we raised taxes in the 90s, the economy got better, and we got a balanced budget for a while. And you'll remember that George W. Bush said we was going to continue our surpluses, and they quickly turned into massive deficits. When Obama took office, three-quarters of the federal debt had been run up by Ronald Reagan and the two presidents Bush, all of whom said that they were fiscal conservatives and turned out to be wild spenders compared to revenue. President Obama has inherited an absolute awful mess and has completely mismanaged it because he has surrounded himself with people from Wall Street who are looking out for the welfare of Wall Street. We have large numbers of people now at the top who pay little or no tax. There's an annual report on the top 400 taxpayers. They're not the same people every year. Most people who've been on that list in the last 17 years have appeared on it one or two times. But if you make $300 million once in your lifetime, you should be well off for the rest of your life. And the average tax rate of these folks is the same tax rate that a income tax rate that a single worker who makes $80,000 is paying. It's the same total federal tax rate that a single worker who makes $26,000 is paying in both income and payroll taxes. The people at the top are not necessarily job creators. If they're putting their money into buying objects to art, you know, the Modigliani painting that sold recently for $85 million plus commission, that's not job creation. If you're buying five, six, seven, eight mansions, many of them outside the United States, that's not job creation. And to the extent you want to count the servants taking care of the property as job creation, if they're outside the U.S., it's not helping us. They are not investing their money in value-added business activities in the United States. And, you know, Doug, there's one other problem I have with this whole idea that tax rates motivate people to hire. I'm the founding chairman of a company. It's a little tiny company. We got 25 employees. We do about $2 million a year of revenue, less than $2 million. Why would I hire someone and pay them a dollar of wages to get a reduction in my tax of from 35 cents to 25? First of all, like most small companies, we don't make a taxable profit. But more importantly, I hire more workers when I have more business. If I can get more customers because people have more money to spend, and especially if they'll pay me higher rates, I'll hire more workers. I want to hire more workers. I'd like to have 2,500 people instead of 25 working for me. But I got to have the business to do it. And that's what's wrong is we don't have aggregate demand. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans in 2008 was $1.01 for every dollar that the same group made in the year 1980 when you control for inflation. 30 years later, people are up 1%. At the very top, for every dollar people made back then, they're making, depending on which group you want to go to, 2, 4, 6, 8, at the very, very top, $36 more in after-tax spendable income. So with this concentration of income and wealth at the very top, it has nowhere to go. There's no place to invest it because people don't have the incomes because we've been holding down wages and pushing jobs offshore. And, you know, in America, we think of taxes as something that bleeds us. The right way to think about taxes is they're part of a circulatory system. And if your venal blood flow and your arterial blood flow don't match up, you're going to have blood pooling somewhere, and eventually it will start rotting, and eventually the infection will kill you. And that's what we need to recognize. We need to recognize that both labor and capital have to have returns in order to be successful. And if you take all the returns and put them to the very highest paid labor, like hedge fund managers, and don't tax them until the distant future, or to the owners of enterprises, huge enterprises, not little two-bit nothing businesses like mine, but huge enterprises, you will eventually end up with the same problem. And I just marvel that we have lost sight of this just fundamental principle of economics. And we've only lost sight of it in the last, decade to 30 years.
One final question. The Republicans, when pressed on tax rates, will sometimes complain that the bottom half of society pays no income tax at all, and this is a terrible thing. What about that?
Well, the Republicans used to complain the bottom half of society paid no taxes. And some people, me in the forefront among them, have been saying that's not true. They may pay no income taxes, but they pay sales taxes, excise taxes, payroll taxes, a whole host of taxes, and they are locked out of things like higher education for their children by tuition, which is a substitute for a tax. Now, why is it that the bottom 50% of Americans pay very little tax, 3.4% of their income in federal income tax, and that's mostly paid by people who are single or couples who are childless? Well, the Republicans. They're the ones who put in the child tax credit in 1997 and has later increased it to $1,000 per kid. So if you're a married couple with two kids, you got to make about $44,000 now before you pay any income taxes. So they created this situation. It's hilarious that they're now in the forefront of arguing that this is a bad thing when they contributed. Fundamental principle. John Locke, you know, not exactly a raging liberal, John Locke said you can't tax the poor because they don't have anything. What did Adam Smith, the father of market capitalism, teach us over 200 years ago? If you impose an income tax on people at the bottom who just have enough to get by, then you will raise the general price of labor at no benefit to the society. That's why a single individual doesn't pay income taxes till they earn about $9,300, a married couple till they earn twice that much money. Getting by $9,300 in America, even if you're single, my goodness, let's see, try to find a place to rent and then feed yourself. This is absurd that we should be taxing people at the very bottom. Better strategy. Let's raise incomes. Let's find strategies that increase the earnings and the economic value people add with their labor so that we have a more productive society and so that people have time and incentives and they get some recognition that it's worth it to go to work and to work hard and try to better yourself instead of, oh, it's terrible, you who are making only $20,000 a year and have a child to support, you're not paying taxes.
Say that to Steve Schwartzman. All right. Thanks a lot, David. I was David K. Johnston, a former longtime reporter for The New York Times, who is now a columnist for Reuters. You can find his stuff on the web by Googling David K., that's C-A-Y, and Reuters. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Adolf Reed. That was some of the second movement of Robert Schumann's Fantasy for Solo Piano, performed by Alfred Brendel. My next guest is Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm sorry about the hum and the audio signal, but I'm on something of a vacation in the Massachusetts woods, and that's rural phone lines for you here in the land of the free. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. So it looks like we're all supposed to rally around the Democrats now because the Tea Party is so terrifying, and Rick Perry is going to lead us back to pre-Civil War America and all that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that if the Tea Party didn't exist, Obama and the other Dems and maybe even Trumka would have had to invent them, right? Because, look, there's no question, right, that whatever those people are and whoever they are, they're crazy. They embrace a strain of horribly reactionary politics, and there are a number of people, some larger number of people out there who identify with them in one way or another, to one degree or another, just as there are some people who think they have a more progressive kind of political orientation who like Ron Paul's nominal anti-war stance, or at least anti-foreign war stance. But I still find it very difficult to accept this Tea Party thing as a social movement or as anything other than, I guess what they sometimes call AstroTurf now, that's just being kept alive and fed by the Koch brothers and other people like that, and of course, the corporate news media. I mean, the most recent thing now with their call for, or I guess their elements call in the House for raising taxes on the bottom 50% of the income distribution, while for all intents and purposes, eliminating taxes on the top one half of 1%, makes it pretty clear what they really are and who they really speak for, as has been the case about this thing from the very beginning, going back to Rick Santelli's Howard Beale moment of being mad as you're mad as hell and not being able to take it anymore. And it also indicates that if all the Democrats would have to do to turn the tide on this element would be to defend the New Deal, even, right? Right, I mean, much less, I mean, to defend, to demand public works investment as a way of easing the employment crisis, to make a couple of sort of fleeting, sort of leftoid populist sounding gestures here and there, to turn things around a little bit, right? To sharpen the contradictions, as it were, on the Tea Party crowd. And they can't do it. They won't do it. I think they're ultimately two sides of the same coin. And I think, like every other sort of incoherent or right-wing nominal insurgency or Potemkin insurgency that we've seen since the John Anderson campaign in 1980, the so-called Tea Party will be kept on a respirator of the corporate news media's attention until it's time to get serious, and then probably some combination of Romney and Huntsman will get the Republican nomination, and we'll have three different pigment shades of the same, or four if you want to count Biden, four different pigment shades of basically the same sort of New Wall Street-centric neoliberal program.
It would be very amusing to watch Romney run against his own health care plan if he does get the nomination.
Yes, indeed it will. But I feel confident that he'll find a way to do it, and that George Will and David Gergen and all the rest of them will tie themselves up into knots.
And don't forget the Nation editorial board.
Right, exactly.
I was amazed to discover during the debt melodrama, the debt ceiling melodrama, that the so-called progressive caucus in the House is actually considerably larger by 10 or 20 than the Tea Party caucus in the House. First of all, you'd never know that by the news coverage, and second of all, you'd never know that by the political outcome, assuming the Progressive Caucus means anything. Which leads us to this perpetual complaint of liberals is, why don't the Democrats fight harder? Why don't they understand? Why don't they have a backbone? They've been without a backbone for so long, you wonder how they can continue to live. So how do you explain this anatomical curiosity?
Well, like you, I was kind of surprised, and I've sort of followed the progressive House caucus over the years. I mean, not closely, obviously, but I was kind of surprised to find that they were bigger than the, significantly larger than the Tea Party crowd. I think there are a couple things. I mean, about that, the slant of the mainstream news media couldn't be any clearer, right? Even the way that they sort of reinterpreted the outcomes of the Iowa Republican straw poll to proclaim Rick Perry the big winner, even though he finished fourth or lower, maybe. And they always do that, right? I mean, that's part of the way that they operate, actually, around all these primaries. and caucuses would be a good object lesson for stat courses, that the numbers, you know, to reinforce the fact that the numbers don't mean anything. It's how the numbers that are interpreted, it's how the numbers are interpreted that means everything. But, so, you know, that's that, right? I think it's also the case that the Progressive Caucus is as incoherent in its own politics as the Democrats are in general. I mean, there's enough, my sense is that there's enough kind of slippage around the edges on the different issue areas. I think they're also, ironically, handicapped by the fact that a Democrat's in the White House, right? And this is in keeping with the observation that the right made gains under Clinton that they may not at all have been able to make, or at least not quite so thoroughly under a Republican presidency, right, because of the lack of Democratic opposition. But the key point is the second point, which is that, yeah, I mean, people have been saying this for as long as I can remember about the Democrats, at least going back to Clinton. And yeah, I've argued, I'm not alone in arguing this, that after a certain point, if you assume that they aren't any more stupid than we are, and they, after all, do this for a living, so they have vested material interest in holding power and staying in power, or gaining power and staying in power, then we've got to assume that there's something else that's going on. And I think you've said this more succinctly than anyone, that they appear incoherent because they're a Wall Street and corporate party that, because of the nature of its electoral constituency, has to make wan gestures to a social democratic, or to a watered-down version of a social democratic perspective, if not agenda. So they always seem to be not following through, gutless, not having the courage of their convictions, when in fact the problem is that they're doing a little bit, and apparently they're doing it successfully, they're doing a little bit of rhetorical tease that they have to do to keep the electoral coalition in line while they govern in the name of Wall Street and corporate interests. And the Republicans don't appear as incoherent because they've been able to put together an electoral coalition around a set of issues that doesn't seem to have anything to do with the fundamental economic and class contradictions in the society, even though they also govern in the interest of Wall Street. I mean, I go back to when, in 96, Falwell and Pat Robertson proclaimed that the Jesus Jamboree that they had in Dallas that year, that what God was most interested in, cutting capital gains taxes. And Bachman and these others can't get away with that now because, the emotional or the symbolic issues that they mobilize around don't seem to have anything at all to do with their economic program. But I guess another facet of the question, or to take another step, is why is it that liberals, and especially left liberals, or progressives, or whatever we're to call them, the people who you read The Nation and watch and you listen to Amy Goodman, themselves can't get over this hand-wringing about why the Democrats don't act with more gumption or the courage of their convictions? Because they've been doing that for a hell of a long time, too.
I never thought I'd quote Lacan in this context, but this is what Lacan would call a systematic misunderstanding of reality. If that broke down, then their whole worldview would collapse, and they'd enter a period of psychotic crisis.
Yeah, well, I think that's it. And I'm not a big Lacan quoter myself, as you know, but I think that about nailed it. Yeah. But Doug, let me just say one more thing about that, because I was just writing in an email to a friend that what stuck in my head, ever since I first saw it, do you remember that labor utilization report that came out at the beginning of 2010 that showed the recovery or the extent of recovery from the 08-09 crisis for different income groups?
Yes.
And what struck me then, and it's clearly stuck in my head for quite some time since, was that, I don't have the report in front of me now, so I can't recall exactly where it cut. But within the professional managerial strata, by the end of 2009, the recovery was almost complete, and you would hardly know if anything had happened. While for most people below them, things sucked and they continue to suck. And I think that fact takes us a good way toward understanding how it is that liberals keep apologizing for Obama and the other Democrats' accommodation and their willingness to sacrifice the lives and aspirations of the vast majority of people who are expected to work for a living in this country in the name of some sort of bipartisan or larger symbolic or longer term, long con kind of whatever, because ultimately, that adoring base in the PMC who liked the idea of having the elite educated or at least trained POC in the White House is much more important than the economic issues because they're pretty well insulated from the downside, basically, or from the costs that are imposed, right, in the name of the compromises that are necessary as we all politic to keep the black president in power so they can continue to feel good about themselves.
I'm speaking with Adolph Reed, professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania. Years ago, you said you thought that the Republicans were being transformed into a rump party of fundamentalist and free market lunatics, and the Democrats wanted to be kind of a center-right party who could count forever on the votes of those to the left because they had nowhere else to go, but they were hoping to pick off the more responsible people out of the center. It certainly looks at that strategy that you were right about that. The only hope the Republicans have now is that the economy is in such bad shape that they would win just because of that. What's your diagnosis? Is that the way things seem to be evolving, the party system?
Oh, yeah, but absolutely is. Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is. And, I mean, a telling point here is that, the AFL-CIO, which is the only institution that's actually in principle capable of immobilizing behind any other sort of politics, when they make the sort of gesture in the slave quarters about being ticked off at Obama and demanding something from the administration, and then start to play around with reaching out to mobilize against the Tea Party, they can't come up with a class argument either. I mean, the last thing that I got off the AFL-CIO blog was like another foolish thing about a weekend of hunting and country music some damn where, because that's they are just as inclined to accept the Joe Sixpack version of who the working class is as the right wing that created that stereotype is. So, that's kind of where we are. I mean, it is like this rump faction. The Dems are very clearly a center-right Wall Street party that feels it can count on, as you said, on votes to their left, because those voters have nowhere else to go. And Obama's been clear about that, and Rahm Emanuel was before him, and Clinton was before him. And it's just been snide, and, it's been like, don't ask me for anything at all, right? Because if you do, I'll cut off access. I guess there is a danger, and one has to keep oneself alive to this, personal reasons of keeping the passport up to date. I mean, there is a danger that something could happen. The bottom could fall out of the economy badly enough that Bachmann could wind up being named chancellor and then Reichsfuhrer. And things could blow up. But I don't think that's especially likely. I mean, as I was saying before, I think what's most likely to happen is that this Tea Party thing will get biddled as the bread and circuses that both left and right, or rather, that both the Democrats and the mainstream, or what remains of a sane Republican elite, kind of depend on to keep the circus that stands in for where a real political debate would be going along until it's time to make the real the real decisions about which line will govern us specifically from 2012 to 2016.
During the debt limit thing, it did seem like the Tea Party crowd was useful for the corporate class in keeping away any threat of tax increases or regulation or that sort of thing. But they're so crazy and extreme that they almost brought the U.S. to the verge of default and greatly humiliated the United States in international financial markets and international political circles. Is this some sort of sign of decay? Are we really spinning out of control?
Well, I don't know. Some days it feels like it, and some days it doesn't. And I can't tell, to be honest, Doug, whether on the days that it does, I'm just too fretful, or on the days that it doesn't, I'm just too frightened to accept the reality. You know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, it could be. I mean, the problem, you know, with this is, I mean, you can see the forces at play. You can see, well, I mean, I remember you said once a few years ago that the problem is, you know, like when people like us tend to sort of think that maybe there's going to be, and this is maybe the case among everybody who has come to intellectual life in the aftermath of the Depression, I guess the Great Depression, that there's a reflex to think that at some point an enlightened wing of the ruling class is going to step in and impose some order just for the sake of maintaining the system and containing the crisis tendency. Some years ago, I recall you observed that, well, there just doesn't seem to be that sane wing of the ruling class anymore, that enlightened wing of the ruling class anymore. And frankly, you know, you think about it, the more they send their kids to Regents University and to Oral Roberts, the more narrow they become. The more the Randian and Hayekian norms of social life take hold within the populace, then, you know, the more it is the case that there's nothing there except, you know, different fractions of capital that are going for theirs, basically. And the devil takes the hindmost. And most important of all, the less of a danger there is of counterattack from underneath in class war. Well, you know, if only one side's fighting in class war, I believe, you know, that's what they call genocide. And there are no restraints. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I would still, you know, like to think that, and God, I mean, what does this say about, you know, the limbing of a political aspiration, but that Soros and Buffett et al. Will have more of a hearing in their own class. But I don't know, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, when you think about it, like the friend who I was emailing in the last couple of days, and this is where he does his work, and it's striking that the same rightist tendency has been hammering in the same way for the same objectives since the mid-1930s, right? And they're now pretty much in power, right? I mean, they've come to set the terms of political debate, you know, the limits of the political aspiration. Yeah.
Well, now we're at the final question here. We said earlier that the Democrats need the Tea Party very badly, and one of the reasons they need it is because they can claim that should the Republicans win, we're going to be run by the Ku Klux Klan. It's going to be back to a raving Jim Crow racial order from 70 or 100 years ago. What do you think of that claim?
I think it's preposterous, right? I mean, I think the most important point about all this is that, you know, everybody across the ideological spectrum now is fighting to claim the mantle of Martin Luther King Jr. Right? I think that's an indication that we've won, or that one version of the struggle against racial injustice has won pretty solidly on both the institutional front and the cultural front. Now, that doesn't by any means mean that there's no more racism in the society, or that there's no more systematic racial inequality, or, you know, inequality that appears in the form of racial disparity in the distribution of cost and benefits in the society. But I think it's important to keep in mind, right, that the apogee of the notion that race was a fundamentally meaningful category in social and political life and a key organizational principle of social hierarchy, both in the U.S. and the world and in all of human history, was the period between the two world wars, right? I mean, the Jim Crow order wasn't fully consolidated until around 1910 in the South. The institutional spine of it was broken by 1965. So as I say in classes sometimes, you know, all four of my grandparents were at least sentient human beings, if not adults, by the time the order was completely consolidated and its back was broken before I was old enough to vote. So it's not like, right, I mean, this is, a fundamental organizational principle of American life. I think, you know, one of the problems that we have, and this is what the anti-Tea Party mobilization desperately depends on, is that it's more comforting and convenient to keep fighting the battles that have already been won. It's less taxing intellectually, it's less taxing interpretively to keep fighting the battles that have already been won than it is to try to figure out how capitalism contradictions present themselves now, how they're anchored, or how the institutional and material foundations of contemporary capitalism connect with ascriptive identities like race and gender and whatnot in ways that are different from the familiar tropes of Jim Crow and slavery. So even the statement that, say, the prison industrial complex is like Jim Crow, or that something else is like Jim Crow, or, say, you know, the Gina case, or the recent killing of the black guy in Jackson, Mississippi, bring back like evocations of an earlier time. Just that construct indicates how much things have actually changed.
That was Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Apologies for the hum, but those are rural phone lines for you. A postscript to Adolf's closing comments on race. I spent a lot of time talking and exchanging emails with him on this topic, and many others as well, and there are few people I feel so in sync with politically. And on this topic, I've learned a lot from Adolf. This line of analysis annoys a lot of people who instantly object that he's underestimating the persistence and virulence of racism in the U.S. and its centrality to all manner of politics, mainstream and radical. On that topic, let me quote a passage from an article he wrote for my newsletter, Left Business Observer, which you can find on the web at leftbusinessobserver.com. I'll put up a link from the front page so I don't have to read a long URL on the radio. Here's what Adolf said. Yes, racism exists as a conceptual condensation of practices and ideas that reproduce or seek to reproduce hierarchy along lines defined by race. Apostles of anti-racism frequently can't hear this sort of statement because in their exceedingly simplistic version of the nexus of race and injustice, there can only be the Manichaean dichotomy of those who admit racism's existence and those who deny it. There can be only Todd Gitlin, that sociologist and former SDS leader who has become, both fairly and his caricature, a symbol of the class first line, and their own heroic truth-telling selves, and whoever is not the latter must be the former. Thus the logic of straining to assign guilt by association substitutes for argument. My position is, and this is Adolf speaking, not me, and I can't count the number of times I've said this bluntly, yet to no avail, in response to those in blissful thrall to the comforting Manichaeanism, that of course racism persists, and all the disparate and often unrelated kinds of social relations and attitudes that are characteristically lumped together under that rubric. But from the standpoint of trying to figure out how to combat even what most of us would agree is racial inequity and injustice, that acknowledgement and 2 1/4 will get me a ride on the subway. It doesn't lend itself to any particular action except more taxonomic argument about what constitutes racism. That's the end of the quote from Adolf Reed. Boiling down his central points to their concentrated essence, unlike the days of Jim Crow, when there was a set of laws that mandated segregation and limited voting rights by race, there are no such visible targets now. So when we look at differential incarceration rates or differences in wealth and income based on race, it's not clear what to do with such discoveries. There are no laws that can be passed to change the way things worked, the way the Voting Rights Act and Fair Housing Act put an end to Jim Crow. The way to fight those evils, and they are evils, is by fighting the criminalization of too many things, and an excessive urge to throw people in jail, and by reducing the quantity of income and wealth at the top and shifting it towards the bottom. And if you get people to work together in those goals, they can build solidarity through activity. But screaming racism won't get you very far at this point in history. It relocates what should be a problem of political economy into the sphere of psychology and subjectivity. For the life of me, I don't know how you address racist attitudes in any public political way. For more on this, I urge you to read Adolf's fine article in Left Business Observer. That's at leftbusinessobserver.com. That's leftbusinessobserver, all one word, .com. Look for the link to Adolf's article on the front page. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Schumann's second piano sonata, performed by another wonder of the musical world, Martha Argerich. Till next week, bye.